Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-7181. Agrocomplex AD, Appellant versus Republic of Iraq. Mr. Mussolino for the appellant, Mr. Blackman for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. Let me introduce Sylvia Rolinski, my co-counsel at counsel's table, and ask the court for 4 minutes in rebuttal. I'd like to direct oral argument to two principal substantive issues, and the first is the third prong of the direct effect, commercial activities exception under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. That is the third prong, including the direct effect test, and subsection 6, which is the arbitration exception. Those are the two provisions of the FSIA under which we sought to assert subject matter jurisdiction. I would note that Judge Walton, when he disposed of the case, disposed of it in his own characterization as a facial challenge on the pleadings and not a factual challenge. He denied any jurisdictional discovery and acknowledged that he was to apply the traditional standard for dismissal as adopted by this circuit, including the provision of appropriate inferences to the pleadings party, in this case the plaintiff. There was some discussion about the burden of proof. We cited El Haddad for the position that the burden of proof rests with respect to exceptions on the party asserting the immunity in the first place and the inapplicability of the exceptions. Judge Walton suggested that...
Leaving aside the discovery issue, would you have been able to have submitted affidavits at this point?
At this point, meaning?
Before he decided. Was it in a posture in which it was going to be decided only on the pleadings, or was it a posture in which you could submit affidavits describing the nature of the financing arrangement?
This circuit has said that the district court has the authority to devise the procedures that are applicable to ferret out the facts appropriate to jurisdiction. Judge Walton did not preclude the filing of declarations of any kind. What we did and what the defendant ended up doing was supplying or providing the documents, including the contracts, memorandum number 2, the 1984 letter related to the contract, and in particular the text of the banking arrangements which provided for the payments in New York. So those documents were submitted because we referenced them in our complaint.
What about that declaration?
Mr. Sonev's declaration? Yeah. Uh-huh. Judge Walton was concerned that it was filed in a reply to the opposition to the motion for discovery, and it addressed principally the absence of records with my client, but it also made a couple statements with respect to Mr. Sonev, who was a principal.
Right. Could that have been filed earlier? I take it the judge felt it was filed too late.
Well, he expressed concern about his use in a reply. He didn't explicitly decline to rely on it. What he ended up concluding was that Mr. Sonev's view that the payments in New York were simply being made by use of an intermediary, and that ultimately the payments in New York belonged to Agrocomplex, was, in Judge Walton's view, inconsistent with the banking arrangements. So while he expressed his concern that the declaration
came... Is that a factual determination?
I believe it's a... We've asserted in our brief that though the judge said he was applying a facial challenge, what he ended up doing, it's our view, is making a factual determination, and the factual determination he made was that the banking arrangements themselves didn't apply to my client's contract, or as he put it,
is your position was it inappropriate at this stage to make a factual determination?
Absolutely inappropriate to make a factual determination in the context of a motion to dismiss and a facial challenge.
What if it had been summary judgment?
Summary judgment is exactly the stage when that sort of determination can be made.
And did you have more evidence you could have put in even without discovery?
Well, one of the reasons we asked for without discovery, ultimately what we ended up doing, and I don't want to, because there still is a motion pending before Judge Walton, is we filed a Smith versus Poland motion with a proposed second amended complaint, after he ruled on the initial on the motion to dismiss, before he ruled on the motion for reconsideration. Accompanying that complaint was more detail describing the procedures as they related to the payments in New York, and accompanying that motion was a declaration from the Bulgarian foreign minister, who was the foreign minister at the time that these transactions were taking place. Now, Mr. Blackman, I think, has correctly objected to the extent that he believes we're arguing that motion and that amended complaint up here, and we've
made clear that. I'm not asking you to give me the particulars of that, only to whether that information should have been submitted earlier. Or did you think that the court was saying it was going to rule on the pleadings and therefore all this factual stuff was basically irrelevant at that stage?
No, as we laid out below, our Bulgarian counsel laid out in detail the steps he had taken to try to get a declaration from the finance minister, who has long since retired, bearing in mind that our client is no longer part of the Bulgarian government. Bol Bank has privatized, which was the National Bank of Bulgaria at the time these transactions were taking place. It's been taken over by an Italian bank. Our client represented that our records were partially destroyed in a fire. When they went to meet with the Bol Bank representatives in their new private formulation, they represented that their records were at least unavailable. So our client ended up tracking down the foreign minister. And had we, of course, had the declaration in time, we certainly would have filed it. Our concern was, because the judge had already expressed some reservations about Mr. Sonez's declaration, that until we got corroboration from someone other than an AgroComplex employee, we weren't really in a position, we didn't think, to prudently go to Judge Walton and say, all right, well, we have another declaration that we would like to supplement. So given those, we offer that discussion not for purposes of saying that the proposed Second Amendment complaint will suffice or not suffice, but for purposes of saying that that to the extent that we say we satisfy our complaint, mostly paragraph 30, which says in particular that the payments were to be made in the United States, some of the payments were to be made by, through, and into banks in the United States, that was sufficient in the first place under a dismissal standard. And the fact that additional facts were available through the finance minister of Bulgaria discovered later only confirms that the application of the dismissal standard, as opposed to some factual test after full analysis of the facts that were available, the fact that there was additional evidence available from the finance minister, we believe corroborates our view that the dismissal standard, had it been applied, would have given us all the inferences, would have allowed for the normal process, even in the context of a subject matter jurisdiction test, to conduct some limited discovery, have a fuller and more complete factual record upon which the court could assess the relationship, if you will, between my client, Agro, at the time,
Could you boil down into a nutshell what your best description is of the financing relationship, the financing arrangements relationship to the contractual breach? In your view, what was the breach and what was the direct consequence in the United States?
The breach was the non-payment by the defendant of its obligations of the contract, first violating whatever the payment provisions were.
Non-payment where?
First, under the contract. There's no provision in the narrow text of the contract. There's no payment there's no provision for the place of payment in the original four corners of the contract.
But the breach is simply the non-payment or the acts of Iraq that led to the impossibility of performance.
Well, the act, to the extent that we're talking about,
what is the act
claim
outside
is the contract, including
what's the act outside the United States?
The entering into the contract and the breach of Iraq's.
Well, entering into the contract isn't itself something that gives you a cause of action, is it?
No, it's one of the essential elements of
it. Yes, but it says in which the action is based upon an act outside the territory of the United States.
Right.
So what is the act that you're talking about?
We would proffer that the act is entering into the contract.
Entering.
And
how could that have a direct effect in the United States, entering into the contract?
And the breach of the contract.
Well, wait a minute. If there were no breach, would there be a direct effect in the United States?
If there had been no breach, that means the contract would have been paid and there would have been no direct effect because the payments would have been made.
Wait a minute. Your payments would have been the effect, the direct effect,
the
not the contract.
Non-payment, ultimately.
A contract between two people, neither of whom has ever been in the United States, can't have a direct effect here by itself.
Correct.
The performance of the contract might have.
Correct.
The non-performance of it might have.
Correct, Your Honor. I agree
with all of that. Which is it here?
Ultimately, but that's why I distinguish between the act upon which the claim is based and the act that creates the direct effect.
What is the act upon which the action is based?
The contract and the breach.
What is the breach?
Effect.
What was the breach?
The breach was the nonpayment under the contract, originally under whatever the payment terms were in the first contract, and then ultimately under the banking arrangements which required payment.
And that was nonpayment to Bull Bank, right?
That was nonpayment originally by Iraq and then
to who?
Originally by Iraq State Agency to Agro.
But the allegation is that Bull Bank financed this, right? So the first payment goes from Bull Bank to Agro, right?
Well,
that's what you've alleged.
Bull Bank's involvement comes as a consequence of a series of banking arrangements between itself and CBI. That's true. The record is weak. Agreed.
Well, the allegation is that Bull Bank financed the AgriComplex ventures, right? And I understand that to mean that AgriComplex would advance money, that Bull Bank would advance money to AgriComplex, and then the Bank of Iraq is to pay them back, to reimburse them? Is that right?
But that's not what happened, Judge. And that was our problem with where Judge Walton went. Judge Walton ultimately speculated that the relationship, because the word financing was used, must have meant that what happened was that Bull Bank paid Agro and basically assumed.
But what did happen then, if that's not what
all that happened, Your Honor, is that Bull Bank, as part of the socialist state of Bulgaria, negotiated with CBI as part of the socialist state of Iraq every year through these annual sessions. And every year they would get together and work out the fact that Iraq was behind in its payments to, as the banking arrangements refer to them, Bulgarian organizations. The 17th session, as opposed to the 15th session, but the documents we have from the 17th session show that the payments deferred, because the banking arrangements say, according to the principles of deferred payment, required the payments to be made into New York by CBI to Bull Bank. But there's nothing in the record that suggests, other than the court's construction of the word financing, that in fact Bull Bank had already paid Agro. If, of course, Bull Bank had already paid Agro.
Well, how do we know that 17th session had anything to do with AgriComplex? It's after the relationship was started, right?
It is, Your Honor. It is the after. But what we've posited is that we have the 15th session, we have the 17th session, we have the 18th session, and every year the two countries would get together and work out the various arrangements involved with respect to the debts were owed to the various Bulgarian organizations. And each year, those payment plans we posited changed depending on the negotiations. At some point,
but your complaint doesn't even mention the 17th session, does it? It gets it wrong. I thought it mentioned the 15th session, and then you've attached the 17th session to it.
The 17th session is mentioned at paragraph 34, 37, and 38. It's at the joint appendix of 65 and 66. But we laid out as best we could what we had, the history of these annual sessions, and our position is that though we don't have a complete history, and for all we know Iraq does, but no discovery was permitted, they show that the payment arrangements were developing over time and changing over time. This contract was signed in 1984. It was going to operate at least through 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait.
Can I ask you to step back again all the way to the very beginning? Okay. The act, you say, is the contract and the breach.
Yes, sir.
What was the breach?
Breach was nonpayment.
Nonpayment for having destroyed equipment, nonpayment for not permitting the project to go forward, nonpayment for what?
Two things, Your Honor. For having the project destroyed under the special hazard section of the contract, but also for nonpayment under the remaining provisions of the contract, because when Iraq invaded Kuwait and UN imposed sanctions, Iraq suspended its payments to various
Okay, creditors. So if they had not breached, where would they have paid the money?
If they had not breached, at least as of the 17th session, they would have CBI would have paid Iraq's obligations under the contract to Bull Bank's credit liens account.
This was a regular way that the contract worked with each when the contract was actually working, when Agro was performing and Iraq was paying. Where did Iraq make its payments to?
Well, there is no way we can tell from the record where actually.
What do you believe was supposed to happen?
What was supposed to happen was that, according to the actual banking arrangements, Agro would perform work. Agro would submit an invoice, and this is by the time of the 17th session. Agro would submit an invoice. It would submit it to Bull Bank. Bull Bank would submit the invoice to CBI. Bull Bank would keep a ledger on its account for all the Bulgarian organizations doing work in Iraq, which would show a debit owed by CBI to Bull Bank for the agro account. CBI would keep an agro ledger. This is all laid out in the banking arrangements. It would show a credit owed to Bull Bank by virtue of the invoice that was received from agro. And there would be no exchanges of money on the basis of those ledgers immediately. Those weren't bank accounts. Those were ledgers. Then, pursuant to the deferred payment schedule, which were payments that were going to be made semi-annual for a number of years, depending on what banking arrangement we're talking about, CBI, on behalf of Iraq, would make a bulk payment into Bull Bank's Credit Lyonnais account in New York. We say that what would then happen is Bull Bank would forward its payment for the contract that we're interested in to Agra. The problem that we believe the trial court had was
I don't want the problem that the trial court had. First, you got a problem me understanding what's happening. Okay, so let me just pause there for a moment. So is your allegation that at some point some amount of that gross amount that CBI was supposed to pay to Bull Bank wasn't paid?
Was not paid. Correct, Your Honor. And as a consequence, my client didn't receive its payment because, though the judge seemed to suggest that my client was paid by Bull Bank in this what was referred to as the financing arrangement, as it's described in the banking arrangements, is a financing arrangement according to deferred payment principles. All that was happening was that Bull Bank, on behalf of the Bulgarian government, was negotiating payment schedules with Iraq. And it negotiated the payment schedules, requiring my client to, if you will, defer its rights under the contract in terms of payment so that the payments could be made ultimately into Credit Lyonnais in New York through the intermediaries of CBI, the Central Bank of Iraq, which I think everyone agrees was an agent of Iraq, and through Bull Bank, which was, in a socialist country, the National Bank of Bulgaria at the time. So our contention is that we agree that we could use some fleshing out of the record when the time comes as to the relationship between Bull Bank and Agro in the first place. Paragraph 30 of our complaint and the details that followed, 31 through 39, make very clear that the payments under this contract at some stage, whether it was in 1984 or later, but certainly by the time of the 17th session, 1986, I believe, the revised payment arrangement explicitly provided for payments from Iraq to CBI to Bull Bank and ultimately to our client. And that is our proposed construction of these instruments.
And your proposed direct effect is that less money flowed from Iraq into Bull Bank's New York account. Is that right?
And just as with Weltover, the fact that the party who's asserting the claim is a corporation that doesn't have any other business in the United States doesn't mean the direct effect isn't sustained in the United States in the first place. There are two subsidiary legal arguments that seems that have to be addressed, and we talk about the commercial bank case, which is a Second Circuit case, where the court made very clear that the fact that in that case the plaintiff was part of a consortium of lenders with the lead bank, and the lead bank was the one who had the right to make the demand in New York. And the question there was whether one of the non-lead banks had standing to sue when the payment right was really vested in the lead bank. And the Second Circuit said, well, the lead bank is just acting as an agent for you for purposes of collection, and the direct effect applies here. We also have another argument that's addressed, I think, at length in the briefs. Judge Walton disagreed as to whether or not the direct effect had to be felt by the plaintiff, or since there's nothing in the statute that says the direct effect has to be incurred by the plaintiff. And that's why we distinguish between the act as it relates to the elements of the cause of action, Your Honor, and the act that creates the direct effect. The act as it relates to the cause of action will be broader in this particular case than the act that creates the direct effect. Clearly, the Direct Effect Act is the non-payment in New York. Could I talk briefly about if I'm not sure if
I... beyond your rebuttal time as well.
Just one brief question, if I could, for 30 seconds on the arbitration.
If we need to reply, we'll ask you after we've heard from opposing counsel. Mr. Blackman.
Thank you. The contract here, Your Honors, was between the Saddam era Iraq and AgroComplex. It had nothing to do with the United States. It did not require performance or payment in the United States. It provided for any disputes to be resolved by arbitration under Iraqi law with exclusive jurisdiction in Iraqi courts. And Judge Walton correctly held that there was no FSIA jurisdiction on those facts. I'd like to direct the court's attention with reference to some of the things my friend was saying about what's in the documents to pages 123.
Mr. Blackman, could I, just before we get to the factual dispute, if it were as your friend described, would that be immune or not immune?
There would not be immunity without some additional things which are not pleaded. I mean, he's thrown around allegations of agency. There's no pleading in the complaint.
Imagine it were as he described, which was that the breach of the contract is the failure of Iraq to pay, either to pay for destruction of equipment, which he says is provided under the contract. I'm not, just accept for the moment that all this is true. I have no idea whether it is, but assume contract provided they were to pay if they destroyed equipment or something like that, or they were to make performance impossible. And that the method of payment was Bull Bank originally advances money to Agro, and Iraq pays CBI, which then transfers the money to Bull Bank's U.S. account. So that the consequence of the failure of the breach is that Iraq does not transmit money to CBI to the Bull Bank account because they're not going to pay them for this. Would that be covered?
No, no jurisdiction.
And why not?
In this case, because that's a claim of Bull Bank against CBI, or if you accept this unpleaded agency allegation, Bull Bank against Iraq. It's not a claim by Agro. On that hypothesis, Agro has been paid. And in fact, that is what the record shows. Banking arrangement number one, which I was directing your attention to, Lee says things that are not as my friend characterized them. That's the document, and what the document, which is properly considered on a motion to dismiss since it was put into the record and cited selectively in the complaint, says that in fact what will happen is that payments to Agro will be, and other Bulgarian contractors, assuming this applies at all, shall be affected by means of irrevocable documentary credits, letters of credit, opened by CBI or Rafidane Bank, which is another state-owned Iraqi bank, with Bull Bank in favor of the Bulgarian exporters.
Will you remind me of the citation?
That's on page 124 of the record.
So this is banking arrangement number
under,
one.
Yes, under Article 1 of banking arrangement number 1. So what that means is that, assuming these documents are applicable at all, AgroComplex is being paid under letters of credit that are issued in its favor by CBI, and those letters of credit are funded. The means of making the payment comes from Bull Bank to CBI. That then results in a debit, a debt owed by CBI to Bull Bank. And what's going on in New York is CBI reimbursing Bull Bank for the credit thus advanced. That is a different case. That is not the case of AgroComplex versus Iraq. Indeed, although the court need not make such a finding, the only possible conclusion of this, which is a pretty standard trade financing arrangement, would be that AgroComplex doesn't have standing, Judge Walton alluded to this, because they were paid under the letters of credit. That's what these arrangements, in fact, say, and counsel cannot change them when the words are on the page and Mr. Tsonev in his belated declaration.
Let me ask two questions. So first of all, your argument is that Agro, in fact, got all the money to which it was entitled? That is,
We're not litigating the merits here.
That's a standing question. You say that they were actually paid by Bull Bank?
Assuming these arrangements apply, we all agree the contract itself says nothing about place of payment. Uh-huh. Assuming these arrangements apply, by definition, a debt that related to this contract would not be owed by CBI to Bull Bank unless CBI's LC had been drawn by AgroComplex. We also say, and that goes to an issue that Judge Walton didn't reach, that whatever claim AgroComplect had was released as part of the Iraq debt reconciliation process. But that's the merits. And here we're dealing with jurisdiction. And the basic issue is whether we can, assuming these arrangements apply, take that and convert it into a direct effect within the meaning of Weltover. And I think the answer...
You said assuming these arrangements apply, did you say CBI had no debt to Agro? Was that your
point? No, I'm saying assuming these arrangements applied, CBI would only have a debt relevant to this contract to Bull Bank if CBI's letter of credit in favor of AgroComplect had been drawn. Otherwise, there would be no letter of credit to have been funded to give rise to the reimbursement obligation.
As your point, Bull Bank's the appropriate plaintiff here.
Bull Bank is the appropriate plaintiff, if anyone is, and CBI is the appropriate defendant. And notwithstanding what my friend says, the fact that an entity is an agency or instrumentality of a foreign state within the meaning of the Sovereign Immunities Act, as Judge Ginsburg addressed in the Transamerica case, is a far cry from agency in the sense of principal agent. An agency or instrumentality is a term of art. It means a wholly owned entity owned by a foreign state, presumed under Banchek and its progeny, to be a separate entity, not responsible for the debts of the parent state. And you need to have an extraordinarily high degree of control and interference of the sort that was discussed in the Transamerica case to create agency in the common law sense, such that the actions of the, quote, agent or agency or instrumentality can be attributed to the principal. The mere fact that CBI is the central bank of Iraq and the fact that at the time Bull Bank was the Bulgarian state-owned foreign trade bank does not create agency relationships in the jurisdictional sense.
Set the standing issue aside just for the moment. If you have a situation in which Iraq agrees to pay Agro a certain amount or agrees to making a certain kind of payment, and Iraq breaches that agreement, and as a consequence, Bull Bank doesn't get the money. Bull Bank in the United States doesn't get the money. Is that not a direct effect?
I don't think it is. It's an indirect ripple. You know, there's a wonderful line in Henry James's preface to Roderick Hudson, his first novel, in which he talks about the fact that when the narrator has to draw lines, he says the ripples really end nowhere. But
is there a case that cites that?
No, I cited it.
I think he's trying to get one.
is there a case?
No, there is a case. Actually, one case that actually has this sort of ripple language is the United World Trade case in the Tenth Circuit. That was the case of the Kazakhstan enterprise, and the Kazakhstan enterprise was actually payable by a bank account in Paris, but because it was dollars, the dollars, as almost all dollar payments do, have to flow through somebody's hands in the U.S. banking system. That's how dollars get transferred. And the court said that the referred to, and I quote, Congress did not intend to provide jurisdiction whenever the ripples caused by an overseas transaction managed. Pardon me?
So you do have a ripples case.
I do have a ripples case. I thought you were referring to the Henry James quote. I'm hoping you will include that in your opinion, because I think Henry James deserves judicial support, as well as that of English departments.
I don't think he'll do him any good at this point.
Well, you'll never know. Wherever he is, he might appreciate it. But the point is that ripples do, by definition, spread indefinitely. Congress drew a line in the FSIA. And that line was recognized by the Supreme Court in Weltover and by the subsequent decisions of this court. And that line is the direct effect test. No intervening effect, no intervening action. In this case, no intervening other persons. On their theory, on the plaintiff's theory, we have to look at the intervening action, first of all, of banking arrangements made 2 years later, which there's no indication apply here at all. We then have to say that under those banking arrangements, CBI is to issue letters of credit to AgroComplect, funded by Bull Bank, which CBI is then supposed to reimburse, and that results in the payment to the account of Bull Bank in New York. And I would submit on its face that is not direct effects. Those are indirect effects.
Why couldn't the arbitration agreement, the arbitration hearing called for in this, occur outside Iraq?
Judge Walton found, and correctly so, that the only way to construe this provision, Article 69 and Article 72 of the 73, rather, of the contract was to provide for arbitration in Iraq, and he did so because, principally, of the exclusive jurisdiction of Iraqi courts in Article 73, and to a lesser extent, the fact that the contract refers in the arbitration clause of Article 69 to arbitration pursuant to the Iraqi civil code.
But the question I have is the location of the arbitration hearing. Is there anything in the language of the agreement itself that precludes the hearing, not the enforcement of the arbitration decision, but the arbitration hearing itself from taking someplace in a signatory state?
Because of the exclusive jurisdiction of the Iraqi courts, if the hearing were held anywhere else, by definition, it would fall within the jurisdiction of that state. That state would then have the power.
What if you had the arbitration on a cruise ship in the middle of the Pacific?
Assuming the hearing was in a New York Convention signatory, which is required to have 1605A6 apply, that signatory state's courts would then, under the New York Convention, have the right to annul an award and also the right to enforce the agreement to arbitrate, both of which,
are
inconsistent with the exclusive jurisdiction of the Iraqi courts. If the Iraqi courts have exclusive jurisdiction, then a U.S. court, by definition, has no jurisdiction, nor a court in any other signatory state to the New York Convention, and therefore the arbitration provision only works and the contract only hangs together, as all contracts have to, if you assume, even though it's not directly stated, that the arbitration was to be held in Iraq. And that's also consistent with the rather lengthy discussion of Iraqi government contracting during that period and the Jalili article, which Judge Walton cited and relied on, in which he pointed out that in these government contracts, the foreign contractor, for better or worse, was committing itself to arbitrate in Iraq. And if they didn't like it, they needed to do something different than this standard contract, which is, in fact, the contract that was entered into between Bull Bank, between Agrocomplex and Iraq. On this issue of discovery, very briefly, the record in this case is unusual because what it shows is not merely a claimant in search of a jurisdictional theory, but a claimant almost invariably coming up with a little bit more too late. First, we have a complaint which has a very perfunctory allegation in paragraph 30 that payment was to be made. It never says, by the way, by or to whom. This is all very intransitive verbs here, deliberately pleaded as such. Payment was to be made by or through a bank in the United States in part. And I emphasize in part because if their theory were correct, it would be in full. So, I mean, basically this is fishing for a theory while trying, in my view, not to push the Rule 11 envelope too far. Then after that's fully briefed, then and only then do they demand discovery, and then at the same time they moot that request by amending their complaint as of right, as they have the opportunity to do, because it's the first time around. And there they add in the words, in part, by and through and into, still not saying by whom, payments by or through and into. And then they follow that in the next several paragraphs by quoting from these banking arrangements documents, making them obviously properly subject to consideration on a motion to dismiss, when in fact what those documents show is what I've just been saying for the last a few minutes. And then, after that's all over, they ask for discovery again after that briefing is done. And in a reply brief on their motion for discovery, they come up with Mr. Tsonev, who is their officer, who could have, if he had anything to say, surely said it over the previous year during which this briefing was going on. This complaint was filed in January of 2007, and we're now down to November 2007, when Mr. Tsonev makes his appearance. So, I mean, what's going on here?
If leaving aside what's going on here, if paragraphs 8 and 9 of the TSONEF declaration were actually factually correct, would there be immunity? Particularly paragraph 9.
You know, I hate to give a slightly indirect answer. You can't.
Especially in a case about direct effects. That would
okay. I'm not sure the answer is yes, but I do know that you can't put in an affidavit that contradicts your own documents and create a litigable issue in any context.
That's a different question. If it were correct, what he says, particularly in paragraph 9, that Bull Bank was just Agro Complex Bank, and these were just payments into Agro Complex account, as they would for any bank customer, that's what he says, then this would be pretty close to Weltover, wouldn't it?
Well, it still wouldn't be, because there's a banking issue here. There is no allegation, nor could they be, I don't think it's the fact, that Agro Complex had an account at Bull Bank in the United States. What they are really simply saying is that a payment owed to Agro Complex in Bulgaria, I would submit, passes through Agro Complex Bulgarian Bank, Bull Bank, through Bull Bank's account at Credit Lyonnais in New York, which is, again, correspondent banking. All dollar transfers have to pass through somebody's account in New York to ultimately result in a credit in the account of the ultimate beneficiary. So even there, I would say this is different. You would have to have allegations, which we don't have, that there was a contractual arrangement between Iraq and Agro Complex to say, we will pay you Agro Complex in New York, not we will pay you Agro Complex and the money will pass through your bank's account at its correspondent, Credit Lyonnais, in New York. So even if Mr. Tsonev were properly before the court, which for the reasons that Judge Walton indicated, I don't think we should find, I don't think that would do it. But I don't think you need to get anywhere near considering Mr. Tsonev or his allegations about mysterious fires and all the rest of it, which cast a little doubt on Mr. Tsonev.
Thank you, Mr. Blackman.
Thank you.
Is there questions for Mussolino?
I don't think you should.
Okay. I'll give you a minute, Mr. Mussolino.
Thank you. First, the banking arrangements, particularly at the joint appendix at page 124, are a little vaguer than my friend suggests. It says, after laying out the provisions as I've already described on the joint sort of matching accounts, the payment shall be effected by means of irrevocable documentary letters of credit opened by CBI or Rafidim Bank with Bull Bank in favor of the Bulgarian exporters or by any other means of payment stipulated by the contracts. And then it goes on to talk about the presentation of documents. There's no suggestion at all that there was any payment that went to Agro, even by means of the documentary letters of credit. And there's certainly no suggestion by anyone that my client had a letter of credit upon which it could act. It was, as we said from the beginning, waiting for the payment from CBI to Bull Bank for it to get paid. And even Judge Walton, when he's positing the theory that my client could proceed under Bull Bank, says that perhaps Agro, the only available claim, he says, is at the joint appendix at 30, and he repeats again at 46 in the denial of motion reconsideration, is that Agro Complex should have sued Bulgaria for Bulgaria's failure to pursue its claim against defendant. So even Judge Walton understood that there was no payment from Bull Bank to Agro for which Agro was seeking reimbursement. And I would note, if you look at the banking arrangements, there's nothing in the banking arrangements that requires Bull Bank to go to CBI and say, look, here's our check where we gave the money to Agro, so reimburse us for our payment, which is, I think, Mr. Blackman's theory. And the only proof that Bull Bank had to supply in order to get the payments going through Credit Lyonnais was that Agro had submitted its invoice. If, in fact, as they suggest, what's really happening here is that Bull Bank is being reimbursed for a payment it already made, either through a letter of credit or otherwise, then it seems to me that it's fair on a motion to dismiss to assume that that would have been the threshold presentation requirement. Bull Bank, you want reimbursement for your payment to Agro? Show us you paid Agro. So, to the extent that we're talking about a motion to dismiss, it seems to me if we're getting any inference on the construction of a contract, the inference should be that there is a way to reasonably construe this banking arrangement that is consistent with the theory that Bull Bank was simply serving as an intermediary for me. Secondly, with respect to principal agent, I don't disagree with the cases upon which Mr. Blackman's relying, except that we are not making a respondeat superior argument. We're not talking about whether the foreign state's responsible for the acts of an agency with applying the control test. We are talking, as we say in our brief, about a narrow Commercial Bank of Kuwait agency arrangement where for one particular point in time, one particular party was acting on behalf of another party, and that's the extent of the agency. This is not a respondeat superior question. All I can say about the ripple, as you keep me, is that Mr. Blackman could cite the same literature and authority for the Weltover case, because those payments were made into a New York, it says, on the New York market, is the phrase in Weltover. Briefly on the reason that we're talking about payment in part was the only payments that were being made in New York under the memorandum agreements were the payments that were being made in American dollars. The contract was split up into Iraqi currency and American currency. The Iraqi currency was being used to pay the Iraqi workers and buy Iraqi equipment, and 55%, I believe, of the contract was being paid in dollars. So the Iraqi portion of the contract wasn't going to be paid in New York. Only the dollar portion, and that's why the phrase in part is in there. The fact that all transactions at some time make their way through the United States, that's not the basis for our claim of a direct effect. Weltover makes clearly the direct effect has to be more than trivial. What the Supreme Court has said is, for instance, the fact that a transaction has to be made in dollars isn't enough to create a direct effect in the United States. We're talking about a payment that had to be made on behalf of my client into Credit Lyonnais in New York. And with respect to arbitration, the only basis for the rejection by Judge Walton for the application of the arbitration exception was his conclusion as a matter of law that this contract, which was silent on the place of arbitration, necessarily required the arbitration to take place in Iraq. The fact that an Iraqi court may or may not, depending on how you interpret that clause, ultimately have to be the first court that affirms or confirms that award has nothing to do with where the arbitration actually takes place. And is concerned that if we conduct the arbitration in Paris or in France, as in the Creighton case, that the French courts have the right to enforce the arbitration agreement and the arbitration award, leaves out the fact that the French court is going to be confronted by Iraq, who's going to say, look, under the arbitration clause of the contract, the arbitral award first has to be confirmed by an Iraqi court, and so the court in Paris or the court in London or the court in the United States or the court in anywhere is still going to apply that forum selection clause before it enforces the award, because I don't hear any Iraq arguing now, and I know they won't argue then, that the forum selection clause somehow evaporates simply because the arbitration proceeding takes place. There's nothing inconsistent at all about the forum selection clause. It just.
Mr. Lane, I think we have it now.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Case is submitted.